Welcome to The Athlete and the NARP. I'm Jenna Daly, and I'm the athlete.
And I'm Claire Fenton, and I'm the NARP. And if you don't know what a NARP is, then you're one too. Welcome to the 13th episode of The Athlete and the NARP. Today we're going to be discussing the multiple cases that have been brought against the NCAA in regards to back payments for former and really future college athletes and the new scholarship distribution format that has been discussed and likely will be implemented partly as a result of these cases. And we actually got kind of lucky with this particular topic because it was something that Jenna had actually brought up last week or so as something like, oh, this is these cases, we could discuss them. I know this happened earlier in the summer. I had never heard of them, but I was like, okay, yeah, it sounds interesting. Let's look into it. And then it turns out just like a couple days ago, there was a new development in the case. So it's actually very, very recent. And so kind of exciting that we get to talk about something that is developing kind of as we're doing this episode. And we'll have future developments towards the end of the month after this episode is released. These are, like I mentioned, legal cases that have been brought against the NCAA in court. And Jenna's more into the pre-law side of things, so she's actually read more of the legality behind these things and read excerpts from the actual cases themselves. And so she's going to kind of talk about it from that perspective, and then we'll kind of just get into discussing these implications and what it could mean for athletes in the future and our thoughts on it.
There's three cases that are grouped together in this settlement. There's the House v. NCAA, which is the original one that took place in California. There's Hubbard v. NCAA and Carter v. NCAA. So they all address very similar things. They're all slightly different, but pretty much they're talking about, as Claire mentioned, payment for back damages specifically related to NIL, academic-related awards, and other benefits. And as we'll talk about coming up, there's a significant amount of money laid out in these back damages. And so what you need to know to establish this is that they're actually going to be paying $2.78 billion in back payments over the next 10 years to athletes from 2016 to 2021, right before NIL. And there's a lot more technicalities to do with this, and we'll kind of unravel those as we go. But that's kind of the basic for that one. The second concern that the settlement talks about is increasing benefits from institutions to student athletes moving forward, specifically to do with NIL and basically giving them the credit that they deserve, giving them the money that schools are generating based on their NIL. So rather than athletes setting up agents and their own initiatives to benefit from this new power, the schools are actually kind of instowing that power in them just playing. The most important part to know about that, I think, before we talk about it, is that schools are expected to pay about $20 to $23 million. And just to be clear, this is for Power Five conferences and any schools in there. So we'll talk about in a little bit. There's a lot that we will be covering in this episode. It's probably our most technical one to date. The important part is that these settlements are specifically about the Power Five conferences. And so this $20 to $23 million would be per Power Five school per year on an NIL basis. And the agreement in the settlement at the moment is that they would have this power in exchange for the NCAA having more rulemaking power to ensure that college sports remain competitive and unique, because that's what the NCAA has maintained this entire time, that that's what they are seeking to do. And then the third main concern in the settlement is they are switching to eliminate scholarship limits in favor of roster limits, which I think has been probably the biggest conversation starter out of this that I've heard. I don't necessarily know if that's truthfully out of in general what this like the common sentiment is, but for me, that's the one that people that have brought it up to me, that's they ask about the scholarship versus roster thing. What makes it really relevant right now is that they actually submitted terms of the settlement to a federal judge, but they blocked it because they were concerned about a clause related to like the booster collectives. And apparently the clause emphasizes that you have to prove payments or for valid business purposes, which doesn't necessarily mean NIL or pay per play. So the federal judge is really worried about the NCAA basically being able to eliminate collective payments. It's just really hesitant about the wording. So the judge said you have 3 weeks to basically clear this up and make it a lot more explicit of what you're expecting from these collectives and from these payments. So that's kind of the landscape that they're working with right now. There's just a lot in these cases, honestly, and so a lot to unpack. But then also, as we were going, we both had a lot of questions about a lot of different things, and so there's a ton of implications and consequences that can follow from this settlement, which will be very, very interesting to see in the next 5-10 years. And so this is a big, I would argue this is a precedent that's being set, and so it needs to be handled very, very delicately, which it may or may not be right now.
For sure. I think it's definitely, like you said, setting a precedent in the sense of it's really trying to define what this new era with NIL will look like for college sports in the future. Because I think for the past, I guess, almost five years since the Supreme Court ruled that NIL was allowed, we've kind of been living in this gray area of, right, these athletes deserve their NIL, but also at the same time, when there's no regulation on it, the NCAA landscape is being transformed into something of a almost like a pro landscape for some sports, because athletes are just almost being, you know, given salaries based on which schools have the biggest, for example, booster collectives, and can just essentially pay athletes a salary on top of their scholarship to come play for them, which is not necessarily what I think the NCAA's vision for college athletics are, and honestly what a lot of fans' vision for college athletics is. And I do just want to expand upon the roster point, because truthfully, I think I had to read 5 articles describing the scholarship changes before I really understood what was happening. So previously, the NCAA had set limits for Division I schools on how many scholarships they could give for a given sport. So, for example, football used to be able to have 85 scholarships, and that was it. Basketball, men's basketball, used to have 13 scholarships, and that was it. Baseball used to have 11.7, which is, you know, how can they have 11.7? Well, then we get into the point of not all scholarships are created equal. They're used to be defined, and I guess still is, but it used to be more pertinent within the NCAA that scholarships were divided into 2 categories. You have headcount scholarships and you have equivalency scholarships. Headcount scholarships are scholarships that must be given in full. They cannot be divided among multiple players. So football used to be a headcount scholarship sport. So that meant that there were 85 scholarships to give to the players, and only 85 players could get scholarships, and they would all get a full scholarship. Even though the roster size used to be 120, only 85 of those players would be on scholarship. Same thing for basketball. The roster limit was 15, but only 13 would get scholarships, and those would be full scholarships. A sport like baseball used to have equivalency scholarships, and that meant that you had $11.7 worth of full scholarships, but you could divide that among your entire roster however you wanted to. And so if there's a roster of, say, 25 players, you could give 11 scholarships to 11 players, and a 12th player could get 0.7 of a scholarship. Or you could decide, hey, all 25 players are going to get the same amount of money. We're just going to divide 11.7 by 25. That was up to the discretion of the coaches and the recruiters to decide how they wanted to do that. What this new settlement could bring about is the idea that now there are these limits on headcount and equivalency scholarships don't necessarily exist anymore. It's just about the roster size. So football, for example, is now being cut down from 120 players allowed to 105. But all of those players are eligible for scholarships, and they don't necessarily need to be headcount scholarships. So in theory, the coaches could decide to give all 105 players a cut of the 85 scholarship money that they have. They could also decide to stick with headcount and only give 85 of those 105 players a full scholarship and leave the rest off of it. That's this new area of recruiting that might be a little bit interesting for some schools, deciding where they're going to get the money to give everybody more scholarships if they want to, or whether they're going to just kind of stick with the amount they have and divide it up that way. You know, again, with there being no scholarship limits, that opens the door for you to devote more money to football instead of basketball, if you like, or devote more money to a sport like maybe softball instead of baseball. Like, it allows schools to be a little bit more flexible in how they're distributing their scholarships, which has its pros and it has its cons, depending on, I guess, how much revenue you're generating, and if you feel that you're going to have the extra money to support these sports. And that's, again, where this idea of these booster collectives comes in, where booster collectives, arguably, I would say from some of the research we've done in the past, are honestly not always for a valid business purpose. They're usually just people donating money so that the schools can then dish it out to players. But if some schools have a strong booster program or a strong booster collective program or a strong alumni donations program where they can collect money from donors to then somehow pool into these scholarships in a way that is legal, maybe outside of a booster collective, that allows them to have that extra money to give to those 105 football players instead of just the 85 previously. Maybe some schools can do that, others probably can't. Some schools it will probably benefit, some schools it won't, and honestly, some sports will probably get left behind.
The thing that interests me the most about this specific issue is a lot of the articles I was reading were talking about how to get around the antitrust laws when it comes to dishing out money like this. And some people are like, well, we can't just ignore the fact that these collectives are essentially pay to play. Like, they were saying many schools are giving athletes salaries. And so then the question becomes, will athletes be considered employees of schools? And then the further question is, if they become employees of the school, is there going to be student athlete unions representing them in the future?
Do you remember hearing about that case? I believe it was at Dartmouth, where the men's basketball team tried to unionize.
No. What is that?
I believe it was Dartmouth. They were blocked from unionizing. But it was essentially recent, within the past year or so, because of NIL. They felt that that was something they wanted to do and they were not permitted to. But again, that could, you know, that point could be raised again in the future if we're going to start treating athletes like they're on salary.
Right. That's one of the implications that I'm very interested in seeing. And then the other thing that you were just hinting at is that some schools will be able to pull more money for scholarships and some can't. And I think it'd be ignorant to say that every sport will be treated equally in this situation. And so there might be more scholarship money being devoted to the more popular sports and everything. And so I think that you're just going to see a further disparity between the top achieving, not even achieving, just like
football and
marketing.
Basketball and everybody
yes.
else.
Yes, I was trying to say that more politically correct. But there's not really a way to do that. So
we're not talking like small money either. Some reports from articles that I read, two Power Five conference administrators said they're planning for about 100 additional scholarships per year, which would be $9 to $10 million. Clemson specifically is looking at $5 to $7 million a year. So, you know, this money has to come from somewhere. And again, that it might not necessarily be distributed equally. And the president of Student Athlete NIL, Jason Belzer, he was kind of asked about this idea of schools are maybe going to get this money, maybe not. Where is it going? Like, what happens for the sports that essentially aren't football and basketball? And also in relation to the back payments, like, football and basketball have been the big money generators, big revenue generators for these schools. Nobody said the quiet part out loud yet, that the back payments are not going to be distributed equally to all these athletes, and 90% could go to football and basketball. And Jason Belzer said, it's very likely we're going to see non-revenue sports get massacred. Title IX is going to be a very big battle. How are you going to stop it? It's going to be tough. And so these are some of the other questions that are going to be asked, because, right, if you're allowed to, you know, Title IX, it's the idea that there's equivalency among men's and women's sports, especially as far as scholarships go. And so how are schools going to, I don't want to say play that, but deal with that?
I definitely see a future where more niche sports are gone, and that it's very standardized across colleges of what sports are being offered, probably going to be the ones that drive the most revenue. But to backtrack a little bit and talking about where the heck these colleges are going to get the money for this. So not only are they going to be expected to increase their scholarship money, they are introducing revenue sharing to schools. And so that's a whole different beast in itself, but something that's tying these together. So the new expenses for D1 schools, specifically Power 5 schools, is roughly around $30 million extra. So it's like $5 to $10 million in additional scholarships per year. And then in revenue sharing, it was roughly around like $23 million. Only UGA and Indiana as athletic programs had annual revenues over $30 million in 2023. So to tell all Division I schools, hey, just so you know, you're probably going to have to pay this much each year, and it's only going to increase because revenue sharing, which we'll talk about, is expected to increase every year. I just don't see how that's feasible. Where are you going to pull this money from? I just don't see how, unless you're one of the top, if you're one of the top competitors in a specific sport, especially a high revenue sport, how are you going to succeed? And so I think this is going to have serious consequences for those lower D1 schools or lower sports as well.
That's a fair point. And I think it's an interesting question also for, you know, some schools that have, well, I keep on saying niche, but really by niche, honestly, I mean anything that's not football and basketball. But some schools that have like more niche kind of hallmark programs of their culture, like Stanford, for example, they have the most NCAA championships out of any school. And it's not in football and basketball. Like, they have an incredible swimming program. They have a great like rowing program. They have like these, they're, I guess, classed as Olympic sports that they really excel at. I'm sure they take great pride in the fact that their athletes can succeed in those types of sports. But now at the end of the day, if you're expected to be competing with programs like, I don't, like UGA in Indiana that are making revenue elsewhere, not from those niche sports, then it may not necessarily be feasible. And I think also just to tie it back to our very first episode we did about the conference realignments, definitely still don't think that the conference realignments were a good thing for college sports as a whole. Go back and listen to that first episode if you want to hear our thoughts on it. But you can see now, I guess, where schools are feel like they're being backed into a corner a little bit and having to go after these high revenue TV deals, because how else are they supposed to recruit at the level they want to compete at the level they're in without having the money that their athletes deserve and that are required for them to keep a high level program? So I guess kind of to what you were implying, it just doesn't seem like there's enough money to go around and to fund this, but also honestly, like, tough luck, because they built this, like, it's kind of, you know, yeah, you can't have your cake and eat it too.
That's true. I think this is really going to lead to super conferences really centered around football or basketball. I mean, I think most conferences are already centered around football, but this is just really going to widen that gap between high and low revenue programs. These big super conferences, obviously, with the widening gaps between the programs, that has the really serious implications of cutting those, yeah, as you said, niche slash Olympic sports, just really not the the main ones, the top ones. And that's something that, well, I don't know if I fully agree with this. A lot of leaders in college sports and in the NCAA are saying that they really want to preserve the uniqueness of college sports and the offerings that all these schools have. And they're saying that the one of the potential impacts of this is the cutting of those sports, which just decimates, obviously, the uniqueness of college sports. So my stance is that I kind of disagree about college sports being about uniqueness, because I don't, if that was true, then I don't think football and basketball would be the main topics of these conversations every single time. But I do understand that it is important to have all of these things, because we talk about professional opportunities are unequal for a lot of different sports, and we've talked about a lot with women's sports. But even if you think about, like, I don't know, equestrian or something, it's not like there's a known professional equestrian league and things like that. So college might be the final destination for a lot of people, and those decisions are really important for them. So to be cutting programs or eliminating roster spots, that is a big deal. And so that changes how people are applying to colleges and like what they're thinking in those decisions. I've seen articles from both sides of this issue where there's people on the side of the small sports being like, what's going to happen to us? But then there's also people on the big sports side, so people in football and whatever, being like, I don't know how it's fair that all the revenue we gain might be split and sent to the small sports. And so I kind of understand both sides. I'm a little biased towards the small sports because obviously I run cross country and track, and we're the first to go in most places. But I do see the perspective of, if the football team is the one with the brand deals and the TV network deals, and they're the ones being put on display and expected to do all these things and perform at this level and whatever, and they're the ones raking in the money, and then that just gets sent to the scholarships for other athletes. And I could understand the frustrations of people who are fighting for those roster spots and saying like, okay, well, this is scholarship money that I myself am earning but not benefiting from. So I see that perspective too.
Most of the time, I think when we're talking about college athletics, none of this is really ever the athlete's fault. I think it's the NCAA has been allowed to get away with too much for far too long, and they haven't done enough to treat all their athletes as equals until recently.
Yes.
And I think not even just specifically talking about women's sports, because obviously there are smaller men's sports too that will not see this revenue. I think particularly with women's college athletics, as we've talked about in recent episodes, we've seen how popular they can be when given the platform and given the proper promotion. Especially, I think, with women's volleyball. I think that is more popular than men's volleyball. Women's volleyball is kind of a beast of its own. And like we just saw earlier this year, Nebraska played in front of, like, what was it, 70,000 people?
Yeah, something like that.
Like a crazy amount of people for a women's pretty much preseason volleyball game. Also, with women's basketball in the past year, we've talked about that too extensively, about how when they're given the platform and given eyes and given viewership, people want to watch them. People want to give them big brand deals. People care about them sometimes more than they do the men's basketball players. And so I think, and I'm definitely not arguing that women's basketball, for example, will ever be bigger than college football. Like, men's basketball and college football are beasts of their own that, honestly, this is a whole separate conversation that we won't even get into, should probably be treated as separate entities and not be tried to wrangle into the college athletics format, at least for some of the top programs, because they're essentially feeder systems for professional leagues. But going back to kind of my main argument, if the NCAA had been better about letting these smaller sports shine and give them a platform and give them the viewership that they deserve, not just women's sports, but also, you know, other smaller sports, other more niche sports, then maybe they would have been able to generate more revenue or take a bigger part of the sharing, but they're not. And I think that that really is a chicken or the egg. But I think oftentimes people make the argument with women's sports, well, nobody wants to watch them. I'm like, well, nobody can watch them. They're not available. Like, you, yeah. People don't know what they're interested in or what's exciting to watch if they can't. Like, but you can't just not put these more niche sports or women's sports on a bigger platform and then say, like, well, they don't deserve it because they're not. Well, it's like you didn't even give them a chance in the first place. Like, you need to have a little bit of both before you can say that they don't warrant support, for example. So all that to say, it's somewhat of a tangent, but it is related to this idea of the back payments and right. Title IX, which is where it's going to be like, okay, well, theoretically, you know, under Title IX, women and men deserve equality when it comes to these sports. But
it's actually really interesting when it comes to the back payments,
right?
Based on like the point. Technicalities of Title IX, because one of the main debates with this settlement and the back payments specifically is whether the distributions are considered, which it's back payments and as well as like the revenue sharing and new funds too. So all of it combined, anything distribution money, whether they're considered athletic financial assistance or if it's considered a treatment area under Title IX, because both of those have really different implications. And one of them, if they're considered, I think, a treatment area, then like they have to follow, the settlement has to follow Title IX. And so what that means is also undefined and really confusing, whether that means you have to have equal payments out for back payments and for revenue sharing despite unequal revenue growth in the sports, or if you can tier it and do it by the success revenue-wise, financially-wise, not success of the program, to clarify if that wasn't already clear, but or if they'll do it that way. These other sports have not been given a proper chance to shine, and our stance has always been you need to invest money into what you want to grow money. Essentially, it will be really weird when it comes to Title IX. My worst nightmare would be that this becomes a Title IX issue and then it ends up gutting Title IX. That's my fear. I don't know if it would get to that point, and that's a whole different legal argument, so I won't get into that. But yeah, there's a lot of implications when it comes to the back payments and the distribution of them.
I read an article from a local Nevada news outlet that talked to Nevada's football coach Jeff Choate about kind of what the implications of this settlement and the new scholarship distribution specifically could mean for their program. And he was talking about how it might just be more of an incentive for public schools to recruit locally, because athletes can, first of all, are only required to pay in-state tuition, which is lower than out-of-state tuition. So that takes your scholarship costs down. Some athletes, if they're academically, you know, qualified, could earn other scholarships outside of just the athletic one, and that takes away again from the money that they have to give to this athlete, but this athlete is still on a full ride and essentially has the benefits of being on a full scholarship, but that money doesn't have to come from the athletic department. That'll obviously maybe not benefit schools like, I'm just throwing out names here, no particular reason, but Duke, Vanderbilt, Clemson, Stanford, who have not only extremely high tuition, but can't do that. They don't have in-state tuition. They aren't a public school. They can't recruit in that way. And anytime they're dealing out a scholarship, unless there's financial aid involved, they're looking at that full amount that they have to cover for these athletes, or that their athletes would want to have covered by whatever school they end up going to. And so if an athlete from Nevada is being recruited by Duke and Nevada, for example, and Duke, for whatever reason, can only offer them $20,000 a year, Nevada can offer them the full tuition, well, you know, sometimes that's an easy choice for, I know they're very different schools, but sometimes when it comes down to that much of a difference, you know, you feel like there isn't much of a choice. And so that'll just be another aspect of this that is somewhat interesting. And I'm saying that because the conference realignment, one of the things that we talked about was that these Pac-12 schools that are just these that are getting like blown apart and being sent to all different parts of the country, a lot of them were saying, I chose this school, UCLA, Washington because it was close to home. My family could come see me play. I travel up and down the West Coast. Now, like, they're trying to recruit locally, but they have to convince these athletes it's worth their time to go to Rutgers, to go to Ohio State, to go to Pitt, to go to Illinois, to go take these flights all the way across the country for every single game. And again, we've talked about the mental load that that has on athletes. So there's just so many factors. The NCAA landscape has changed more than probably anybody thought it would over the past 4 years. There's so many factors at play now for recruiters and athletes to consider when they're making their collegiate decision that it's like honestly inconceivable that like a 16-year-old would have to be juggling all of these and decide what is the best choice for me. Is that even Division I? Maybe it's D2, D3. Maybe it's close to home. Maybe it's far away. Like, do I even want to do it? Like, it's a lot.
It's weird to think about the case if public schools were able to benefit more than private schools by recruiting locally. And I was just thinking in my head off of that, okay, would specific public schools thrive more than others? And I was thinking specifically, take football, for example. Okay, your powerhouses are often in the South because you can kind of play year-round. Like, if you were to recruit locally, I'm saying, so you can play year-round. Generally, it's a much bigger cultural impact here, so you probably could get better talent. But at the same time, then I was thinking, because, for example, UConn, amazing at basketball and hockey. The soccer is usually pretty good. Notoriously awful at football. So no one ever pays attention to UConn football, because why would you? But then I was thinking, well, what if those talents in Connecticut are going to the big state schools in the South or in other places and things? So that would be interesting to see if public schools start recruiting heavily locally. And then, for example, would UConn's program essentially get turned around, and would they get that talent, or would they just continue to further suffer and get ignored? One conversation that one of my teammates, she actually used to run at University of Arizona, and so she kind of understands the D1 landscape a little bit more, and she brought up to me the idea of maybe D2 or D3 becoming more popular. And that's something that I've never really, I mean, I think D3 in general is becoming more popular just because I've seen it as a D3 runner, and it's gotten far more competitive each year that I've been here. I mean, and I don't think that running is the sole sport that's happened in D3. So people are genuinely choosing it a lot more lately. And then I don't know if NIL had changed that and like shifted it back. But I'm curious if these decisions with the roster limits specifically are going to have an impact on people choosing D2 or D3 over D1, because it doesn't affect those two divisions. And so if you're someone who really wanted to go to the best possible program you could, but you weren't going to be one of their star players or athletes, then you have to consider, is that really worth it? Because at any point, if you're not good enough, you're getting dropped. And there goes your scholarship, which maybe, I don't know, which maybe funds your education if that's how you're doing it. And so maybe that's where D2 makes a lot more sense, and you go to a really competitive D2 school that's potentially better than some D1s or something. Or you go to Division III if you're not using athletics to fund your education, because they also compete in national championships, and sometimes D3 schools are better than a lot of D1 schools, and I've seen that too. So it changes, as I said earlier, it changes the way you think about these decisions and consider the factors, because they have different outcomes.
I think it will definitely depend on the type of athlete too, because obviously for some people Division III isn't an option if right. There's no scholarship involved. So I think it can also go both ways. For example, like baseball, where now maybe when you weren't eligible for a scholarship before, now you could get a cut of it. Or even something like football, where again only 85 guys had the chance now, and so maybe if you were looking to play Division I but you felt like, okay, I'm not in the top 85, I'm not going to get any money or whatever, maybe now you can still go to a program and get some money off, even if it's not a full scholarship, where before that wouldn't have been an option that was available to you. So I think it will heavily depend on the sport and the athlete that's being recruited, which probably might also tie into the sport. But right, still these dynamics of, you know, how will it affect the landscape of Division I, Division II, Division III is definitely interesting to think about.
And then I want to transition a little bit to start talking about the increased benefits from institutions moving forward, because I feel like we haven't really talked too much about it and just alluded to it. But this is a very odd situation, I think, just because the NCAA, ever since the ruling came out with NIL becoming legal and everything, the NCAA has notoriously just been silent on the issue and hasn't tried to dictate anything to do with it, let it be the wild, wild west. And I know that we've talked about NIL before, and I think I had said, oh, well, I know that when you have legislative bodies and administrations making decisions, it takes forever. But it's very weird to me that they really haven't said anything, and it's been 3 years. So I guess better late than never to be talking about these things. Pretty much what they decided was that all Division I schools, they can use up to 22% of their total revenue, like athletic revenue, to share to future athletes. And this percentage, or at least the value of what they're distributing to students, is expected to increase every year, which I feel like that's wishful thinking because that's already, as I had said earlier, that's a lot of money that you're just saying, oh, you have to provide that. I feel like a bold assumption to say these should increase every year, because I think that's assuming that the sports will become more successful financially, but I don't know if that's necessarily the case.
I see what you're saying, but I think if I don't know how they would become less successful.
I guess, but even if they stay, so say they just stay the same as they haven't done anything crazy, like they haven't secured any additional deals or anything or brought in any crazy additional revenue, then they're just flatlining, they're staying the same. But then the expectation is that they increase that distribution.
Well, I guess they also know that their TV deals that they just signed are bigger than they were previously. So they do know they have extra money coming in.
There was one article talking about this model is apparently optional for schools. Like, apparently it's not mandated in the settlement that they have to do it, but apparently it's an optional structure and that the schools have discretion to select which sports get to benefit from it and which athletes get to benefit from it. So then I think that ties back into Title IX, which just, it's a whole can of worms.
Well, also in regards to, you know, where are they going to get the money? Well, I'm like, well, now those like little fun projects to build like a golf course for football players at your school looks like a little bit less of a nice investment now mm-hmm. than it did previously. Or, you know, the locker rooms with the barbers in them that you built for your
where is
athletes.
That?
It's at one of the, okay. I'm not going to throw out a name and disgrace them if it's not theirs, but those type of projects that, you know, were fun, that you had this extra money laying around that, you know, the athletes don't get any of it. So I guess we have it, might as well spend it. Looks like less of a good investment now. So I really don't have, and I know that only applies to not all the schools, but I don't have a ton of pity for these programs for having to dole out more money than they have on hand, because they've been getting away with this for far too long and now they just have to figure it out.
So the Harvard Crimson actually reported that Harvard is part of the Ivy League, which is its own Division I conference. They traditionally don't have sports scholarships, and they've recently been very anti NIL collective, so they don't have that either. And that's brought up a whole different set of questions regarding that. But the newspaper actually said that the D1 schools that don't agree with this settlement might be barred from competing in NCAA championships. First, I don't know how that's allowed. for context, like one thing I was thinking about is the back payments. So the NCAA has agreed to pay 40% of it, and then the remaining 60% are split between the conferences. So even though the settlement is only between the Power Five conferences and NCAA, the settlement says that Power Five will take, I guess, 40% of that 60%. I think it's roughly like 28% or something of the whole thing. And then the remaining conferences will take the other portion of that 60%. So they didn't even really get a say in this settlement. But then here's something saying that if they don't agree with the settlement, that they're unable to compete for those NCAA championships, which also I think is, if you're really competitive and you're in these final tournaments and championships, that's how you get the views and that's how you get the extra money and sponsorships.
And helps your recruitment.
Yes, exactly. So that, to me, I don't really see how that makes sense.
I honestly, like, I know I've said it like five times. You can obviously see how I feel about the NCAA. Like, nothing they do makes sense. We don't have to pretend they're a functional organization. They just got caught 4 years ago, and now they have to figure out how to make it functional.
Yeah.
So I think they just make up their own rules as they go and like hope nobody calls them out on it, and now they're getting called out on it.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that will actually come to fruition, but
you can definitely see that there's a lot of confusion and it's very disorganized. And there are so many questions that have to do with all these things, and there's not really answers at the moment. There's the Protect the Ball Act that has actually been introduced to Congress to protect the NCAA, and I think some conferences, from specific legal challenges, just because there are so many loopholes in every single part of this settlement. So I don't know if there'll be a ruling on that, like if that'll be passed. I don't know what that language would say, but there are so many future consequences of this that the NCAA has not thought out, and they've had 3 years to kind of
think about it,
mull it over,
think some long deep hard thoughts about what they want to do, and this is the best they came up with.
And yeah, ultimately it took three different cases, into one settlement. There's actually a fourth case that's very similar in Colorado against the NCAA, but it was denied. They tried to get it sent to California to be grouped in, and it got denied. I don't remember the reasoning, but so there's a whole other lawsuit over there. So even once this settlement is finalized, whatever it may be towards the end, the reproposal of it will be September 26th. So pay attention to that date if you're very curious of what they're going to say about these collectives. But even if that is all approved by the federal judge and passed and whatever, there's this whole other thing in Colorado that might just upend the entire thing again. And then we'll just go in another circle. And so I think that's slightly ridiculous. I guess it's a comment on federalism at its finest, just how slow everything moves. But I guess I won't get into that any more than I need to. But it just goes to show that like the NCAA kind of needs to figure its stuff out.
All I know is I wouldn't want to be one of the people that's working on this. I wouldn't want to be this judge.
Definitely not. On this week's Fun Friday, Claire is going to be giving me a value quiz. So how it works is that she'll give me a team and their value initially, and I'll be guessing the next team's value, whether it's higher or lower of that. And so we'll keep going through, and I'll be guessing the next team's value based on the previous team. Mm-hmm. So wish me luck.
Kind of ties in with the whole revenue sharing situation. That's kind of what I was going for, and plus I like making quizzes and looking up lists and things like that. So,
and I love making a fool out of myself on these quizzes. So let's go.
50% chance. Again, we've done something similar to this before, and it's just a 50% chance. So the first one I'm going to start off with is a team that is, I don't know if it's near and dear to our hearts, but we've talked about, is the Oakland A's, which are soon to be the Las Vegas A's within the next few years or so. A floundering program that is near the bottom of the MLB value rankings list, but still comes in at $1.2 billion. So this is where we're starting.
Imagine being a failure, but still being valued at $1.2 billion.
Yeah. When I was looking these up, I was thinking this is a crazy amount of money, but I digress. The next one, team, you're going to guess if it's higher or lower, worth more or less, in the Oakland A's. We have Williams F1 Racing, which is the least valuable F1 team out of the 10.
Least valuable F1 team. It's been around forever.
Yes. Is it worth more or less than the Oakland A's?
This is a really funny quiz because I have absolutely no idea of specific teams or like leagues. And so I'm just going off the popularity and my best guess.
I was
going
to say, as you go through, it'll help you get like grounding when I give you the actual values and stuff. But.
Oh, that's hard. This is actually a hard one for me. I don't know if it's supposed to be, but it is, just because here's my logic. Like, the both teams are at the bottom of their respective leagues, but baseball is really popular in the U.S., F1 is really popular everywhere else, and so I would say Williams is valued higher, but maybe not by much.
So Williams F1 Racing is worth $725 million.
Really? I'm surprised it's not over a billion, just because it's been around forever.
No. So I was actually a little bit surprised too. I was thinking maybe they would all be expensive, but no, not. So this is our next one. So then we're going to compare Atlanta United FC to Williams F1 Racing. So is Atlanta United FC, which is our MLS team, worth more or less than Williams F1 Racing?
It was 725
million for Williams.
Okay. I'm going to say Atlanta United is valued less than Williams, just because I feel like it's not an overly successful program.
Yeah. 900 million.
Really?
Yes. And I think Atlanta United it's not the most valuable MLS team, but I think they are like ranked as having the strongest fan base in the league.
Yeah, so well, I know that, but that doesn't mean success.
No, it doesn't. But they're almost $1 billion, which I definitely found surprising.
I'm actually really shocked about that.
Because neither of us have been to a game.
No.
So, and we've been here for 4 years.
Because that
so.
Determines their value.
Right.
Clearly.
Well, we're both sports fans. We both like soccer.
Right.
We haven't been. It's been 4 years.
Target audience has not been targeted.
Exactly. We'll get out there one day.
One day.
Next up, Florida Panthers. Are they worth more or less than Atlanta United's $900
million? I would say they're valued more than that.
They are worth $775 million, so they are less.
The only reason, I mean, it could have gone either way if I really thought about it, but I feel like it's a higher or lower guess, so I just got to guess. I understand. I guess hockey is probably less popular, and they also just won their first Stanley Cup, so their fan base is pretty good, but it's probably not the strongest.
It's pretty impressive for a hockey team from Florida to
yeah,
be worth
yeah.
that much, in my opinion. So.
That's why I was like, it could be higher, because, I don't know, just because they are impressive. But
sure.
Yeah. I guess it makes sense that they're lower.
That's why I put that one on there. Next up, the Memphis Grizzlies, which are the least valuable team in the NBA. More or less than the Florida Panthers.
I know nothing about the value of any basketball teams whatsoever. Clearly, don't know the value of anything so far. But this one, I'm truly at a loss. So it is just a 50-50 guess for me. So least valuable of NBA. Although the NBA is pretty successful. I don't know if they're like super, super successful compared to the NHL. My guess is higher.
Way higher. Okay. $2.4 billion.
Oh, wow.
Next up.
And they're the lowest? That's surprising.
They're the lowest, yes. Next up, swinging it back to hockey, the Montreal Canadiens, who are ranked third in the NHL in terms of value. More or less than Memphis Grizzlies.
Interesting. See, I'm going to say lower. I don't know. This could be totally wrong. I mean, I guess it could be.
It definitely could be, yeah.
Yeah, but I almost feel like saying it's the third most in hockey is really misleading. Because what was it, $2.4 billion?
Mm-hmm.
That seems like a big number to me, so I don't know.
Well, it's their Montreal Canadiens are 2.3, so it is just under. So there's only two teams in the NHL that are worth more than the lowest NBA team. Next up, after the Canadiens, we're comparing them to the Kansas City Chiefs. Are the Chiefs worth more than the Canadiens?
That's a tough one. My guess is...
Is it?
Higher.
Yeah.
How much higher?
$2 billion higher.
Wow.
Kansas City Chiefs are worth $4.3 billion.
I guess in my head, that's just like an insane number to pay for a team. I don't know.
Just, no, I agree with you.
I guess hard to billions fathom. Are hard to conceptualize, you know? I agree. So once you hit like a billion, it kind of just
goes like,
all,
how can we get more money from here?
But exactly.
You can.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can always get more money. Next up, Ferrari, which is the most valuable F1 team. Are they worth more or less than the Kansas City Chiefs?
I think they're worth more. I don't know if that's actually true, but personal opinion,
well,
I think they're worth more.
I'm about
a
to
lot
tell you,
more.
They are not.
Really?
They're worth $3.9 billion.
Okay. So they're still, I mean, I guess that is a lot of money, but
it is.
3.9 to 4.4, you said?
4.3.
Like, I don't know.
Well, the Kansas City Chiefs are not the most expensive NFL team.
Really?
No. Do you not know?
I told you, I know nothing about the
values.
This will
be a bonus point at the end. So if you don't know, I know off the top of my head what the most valuable sports team is in the world before I looked at this up, but you don't know.
No, not at all.
So that'll be a bonus point at the end.
I won't be able to get it right.
Well, I'll help you get there. Anyway, Atlanta Falcons, worth more or less than Ferrari?
Less.
More.
What?
$4.7 billion.
They're so disappointing.
It's the NFL. That's what you have to think about.
Yeah, but I don't like the NFL.
That's okay, but...
So, obviously, personal bias here. I don't think they should be valued that
that's
much.
That's fair. If we were taking personal bias into account, this might look a little different. Chicago Bulls, worth more or less than the Falcons?
What was the Falcons?
$4.7
billion. 4.7? Oh. Probably less?
Less by a little bit. $4.6 billion.
Okay. I figured they'd be up there, but I didn't think that they'd be that far up there, actually.
New England Patriots, which are the second most valuable NFL team. Are they worth more or less than the Chicago Bulls?
More.
$7 billion.
Which I would have...
I think, yeah. Woof!
$7 billion is crazy.
Yeah.
I would have said that even if you didn't say that they were the second highest. Because that kind of gave away the answer, but I assumed it anyway.
I was just trying to help you along there.
Thanks.
Next up, we have Real Madrid, which is the most valuable soccer team in the world. Are they worth more or less than the New England Patriots?
Oh, more than $7 billion. Less.
They are less. Yay.
Yeah. I almost
6.6 billion.
Okay. I almost went with more, but I was like, soccer to football.
Yeah, which it honestly is. I mean, honestly, I guess it really does speak to the popularity of the NFL that they're worth more than the most valuable soccer team. Like, that is
Because
really
to me,
crazy.
It's like the NFL is an American league, like North America.
Well,
like,
not even to you, it is.
Yeah, yeah. So I was going to say, to me, their major fan base is just Americans.
Right.
Maybe they have external fans, but to me, soccer is everywhere. And you even see it at Emory. All the international students like love soccer, and so that's like their whole thing. So it's just shocking to me that football can just, I don't know.
It is shocking to me that there are multiple American sports teams that are worth more than Real.
Yeah, not honestly, not even just football. The fact, not necessarily just about Real Madrid, but even some of the hockey teams, I'm like, they're valued that much? In NBA too. I mean, really, just
all of
these
them.
Leagues.
Last one before our bonus point. A team near and dear to my heart, the Golden State Warriors. Are they worth more or less than Real Madrid?
And what was it? 6.6?
6.6.
Less.
You should know they would be more.
I would not know.
Billion. If I put them on there, they're worth more. And this is honestly,
you just love Steph Curry, so you're going to put him here.
Well, so does
any
the rest
chance.
Of the world, because what I was just about to say is that I think it is kind of crazy for some of these teams how you can pinpoint that they're specifically driven by a player. Like, Golden State Warriors is because of Steph Curry. Like, sure, but it's because of Steph Curry. Like, New England Patriots, that's because of Tom Brady.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and you
that's
can,
true.
That the value of some of this, these teams can be driven by one player. I mean, Chicago Bulls mostly driven by, like, Michael Jordan.
Right.
Okay, so went through that little list. Now, like I said, I have known the most valuable sports team in the world off the top of my head. You say you don't, so just for, like, a bonus point, based on the way this ranking went and what you know now, do you have a guess at what the most valuable sports team in the world is? And again, it's not one we just went through.
Literally not at all, but it's my guess was that it would be in
league?
The NFL.
Okay, great. Good job.
The only thing, I know this is so probably off base, it would be, like, the Dallas Cowboys.
Ding, 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 ding. It is the Dallas
Which is
Cowboys.
So stupid to me. I don't understand how that's America's team and whatever. And I don't know. Do you know the value
yeah,
off the top of your head?
Of course I know. It's right here.
Of course.
$9 billion.
That's crazy.
Isn't that insane?
Crazy.
Yeah. That's like essentially
and for
eight
what?
Oakland Athletics. Make up one Dallas Cowboys.
Oh, the poor A's.
Yeah.
Hopefully Las Vegas can revive them.
I mean, that's literally like 2.5 Ferraris. 2.25
Ferraris. That's I'm actually really surprised that Ferrari is not higher.
Yeah, I know people are like, oh, you guys love F1 so much, but like it is Ferrari. Like it's a car brand, it's a fashion brand, it's a racing team. Like they are so much more than just like a sports team. That is kind of surprising.
And
that
it's the first, and it is the first F1 team to exist, and it has such like rich history to it. I am surprised that it's not higher. I'm not surprised that it's not the top, because I would say F1 is fairly niche, but it's so popular around the world. Like I already said it, it's just weird to consider these sports that are so America centric, I guess, and then think about
global.
Yeah, and then think about the ones that are globally performed and just travel around everywhere so people can get exposure to them. It's just it's mind-blowing to see these sports. Like, Dallas Cowboys.
I know. I guess it just speaks to, you know, American consumerism. And
I guess
whatever business model the NFL has going on is, you could argue, I guess, the best of the world at this point.
Apparently.
There's billions just sitting around there.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to the 13th episode of The Athlete and the NARP. We hope you enjoyed our discussion breaking down the settlements surrounding the NCAA, NIL, and scholarship changes, as well as our Fun Friday segment where Claire quizzed me on the value of various sports teams. I hope you did better than I did guessing the values as you listened along.
Make sure to follow us on Instagram and TikTok at TheAthleteAndTheNARP. You can contact us by email at TheAthleteAndTheNARP@gmail.com with content suggestions, clarifications, or questions. Until next time. I'm Claire Fenton.
And I'm Jenna Daly.
And this has been
The Athlete and the NARP.